Anyone remember anything from yesterday's class?
Hearing about Sri Krishna's daily activities in Yaptoka.
Anyone remember anything else?
He got up with the sound of a
alarm clock?
Roosters, yeah. And the queens were cursing the roosters for waking up Krishna, taking Krishna away from their embrace.
Anything else?
And did Archimedes touch water and proceeded to meditate upon himself.
And we do some auspicious things, offer respects from the elders.
Yeah.
And he would, what would he give away?
Cows.
How many?
13,000.
And seven, was it 74? Not cows every day.
30,000. In how many groups? Some, yeah. 107 groups?
Yeah. Something like that. So it came to 1,000,000. That's a lot of cows. 1,400,000 cows, 107 groups, yeah, of 13,084 cows.
Wow.
Vadvam, vadvam, dine, dine.
Every day.
And then, he'd come out, and how would he get there? Would he take the bus?
Rickshaw.
How would he get there?
Let's try it.
Chariot.
Yeah.
Mount chariot. And then the queens and all the palace ladies would look at him, and he would barely be able to pull himself away from their glance. And then he would enter Sudam Akyam Sabam, the Sabha, the royal assembly known as Sudharma Akyam. Sabai Vrishnavi Parivaritaha. He would be surrounded there and attended by all the Vrishnis. Pravishadyan Navishtanam. And anyone who entered this assembly hall, Nashantyanga Sadurmaya. There would be none of the six waves. That's all. We talk about certain people being surface, and then we talk about certain people not being surface. But actually, everyone is a surfer of the, in the material world, is a surfer of the six waves. But in Sudharma, these waves, no one would surf them. They would be free from the waves of, which are the six waves?
Lamentation.
Yes.
Hunger.
Material pangs. Namely, hunger, thirst, lamentation, illusion, old age, and death. So once you're in Sudharma, these things would not touch you. So the Lord, attended by all the Vrishnis, would enter the Sudharma assembly hall, which protects those who enter it from the six waves of material life. Dear King, so in the material world, everyone is surfing these waves and trying to ride, get the ride of their life right to the shore on these waves. But there's one wave, that sixth one, known as death, that wipes you out and crashes you on the rocks. Srila Prabhupada writes, It may be remembered that the Sudama assembly house was taken away from the heavenly planet and was reestablished in the city of Dwarka. The special significance of the assembly house was that anyone who entered it would be free from the six kinds of material pangs, namely hunger, thirst, lamentation, illusion, old age, and death. These are the whips of material existence. And as long as one remains in the assembly house of Sudama, he would not be affected by the six material whips. Okay, now think of the two words that are used for here, the two English words. One is a wave and one is a whip. Urmaya means wave here in the word by words. So they do not occur. So why is it called a wave and why is it called a whip? These six things. First, why is it called a wave?
A wave is something unrelenting, a powerful force which comes upon you and overwhelms you.
Big waves. Sometimes they're little, like you're a little bit thirsty or you're a little bit lamentation. Sometimes a tidal wave of hunger will overtake us and knock us right out. Or lamentation, or a tidal wave of illusion. Or the tidal wave of old age, what to speak of, the irresistible tidal wave of
death.
So we try to, we're in the material world, but we have to manage our way. That's what surfing is in a sense, isn't it? That waves, something that's going on in the ocean, and someone sees those, and they worked out a remarkable way to try to enjoy the waves of the ocean. So similarly, we try to enjoy despite the waves of material life, such as hunger, thirst, limitation, illusion, old age, and death. We try to surf these and get some pleasure from them. Okay, now we have clearly explained why it is a wave, and now why is it whipped? Has anyone ever been whipped? Oh, I wouldn't want to get into. Sorry, but not with like a real. I assume, but whipping, oh.
It invites some sort of repetitive, sharply inflicting painful punishment.
Punishment, yes. It is a whip. The whips of material existence. We think of hunger as something to enjoy and thirst as something to enjoy. It's desire that gives birth to enjoyment. But actually it's a whip. It beats us. We have no choice. Forces us into a particular action. And even if we say, I don't want to bother with being hungry or thirsty or lamenting anymore or old age or death or illusion, still the whips force us into a reaction. You cannot ignore a whipping. In this regard, Srila Sridharaswamy and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explained that when Lord Krishna would exit separately from each of his many palaces, each individual form would be visible to the persons present on those particular palace grounds and to the neighboring residents, but not to others. Then at the gateway path of the Sudama assembly house, all the forms of the Lord would merge into one single form, and thus Krishna would enter the hall. What do you think about that? What do you think about that?
Smiling.
Huh? What?
I don't know.
What do you think about it and see what you think about it?
So there were 16,000 chariots of Krishna coming to the hall. That's what I mean.
Huh?
There were 16,100 chariots of Krishna.
Carrying Krishna, chariot driver.
Yeah.
parking problem. Except that there's no parking problem for Krishna because they all became one.
Yeah.
One single form. So Krishna.
They all left at the same time.
Huh?
They all left at the same time.
Well, that's the amazing thing, is because in some places it might have been night or sometimes day, but somehow they all left, even though they left at different times, they arrived at the same time because it was. Because time simply serves Krishna. This is the meaning of that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ekala Ishvara Krishna or Sabhavritya. That everything and everyone ultimately serves him. We either serve him willingly and consciously and lovingly, or unwillingly, unconsciously, being whipped and waved as we go through life. What stops us from serving Krishna? I mean, not in a general way, we could say ignorance.
Maybe we don't believe it's real.
Or maybe, yeah, there might be many reasons. Or maybe we are not quite ready. Meaning that after we finish, checked off all the things on our to-do list, then we'll get around to Krishna.
Well, Bhagavatam says, unless you discuss it in material life, you cannot surrender to Krishna.
We don't like the idea of service. And the prophet says that that's not a very, that one is repulsive to
service, serving someone. But everyone ends up serving anyway, that's for sure.
But I'm willing.
So what happened next? The Krishna surrounded by the Vrishnis. Krishna is considered like the sun or the moon, and the Vrishnis were like stars. As the Almighty Supreme Lord would seat himself, would you like that word? Almighty means vibhu, means very powerful. As the Almighty Supreme Lord, so he's given glimpses of his almightiness. He would seat himself on his exalted throne there in the assembly hall, and he shone with his unique effulgence, illuminating all the quarters of space. Surrounded by the Yadus, lions who were like lions amongst men, that best of the Yadus appeared like the moon amidst many stars. Nrisinga, Vrito, Nrisinga, Yadubir, the best of the Yadus. Yudotama, the topmost Yadu. What's the name of Krishna? That means the first amongst all the Yadus. That's, yeah, the best. And another one, very similar. Yadubar.
Can you repeat that, please?
Yadubar.
Yadubar.
Yadubar. So he sat on his wonderful throne, and yet he was almighty. So I guess this is, in religion they talk about God is sitting on his throne. Maybe they're talking about Dwarka. Maybe. Because he's certainly, and he's illuminating all the quarters of space. And he's almighty Supreme Lord. And he would sit in the assembly hall. This is the closest thing to what people conceive of God, isn't it? He's sitting in a huge hall on a throne, and he's almighty, and he's so effulgent, maybe you can't even see his face because he's so effulgent. What does he do when he sits there?
He controls
That doesn't make any sense. Does it? What else does he do? I mean, controlling everything. If he's almighty, that's only, that doesn't take all his might.
But all light kind of comes from him.
So he's just like having things come from him.
Like the sun.
Yeah, that's what it, that's what it's like. But what does he do?
Place light.
Huh? Well, that comes, that's what he did. What is he going to do when he's in the assembly hall? Now, this is very interesting. Yeah, well, that's where everyone comes to him, because when the king sits in his dabar, in his assembly, then everyone comes to him with their complaints and problems. That's what happens. That's what that's the conception of God that people basically have, isn't it? That he's sitting there and he's just waiting for you to tell him all your problems.
It's like the temple president's office after morning.
And certain petty cash from him, you know, and facilities.
Yeah. I want. And the favorite manifestation of the Lord is Santa Claus, where you give him a list and then he throws it all down the chimney once a year and you get it, whatever you want. He's real Santa. So what happens there? Well, he's not just going to let everyone walk in at this point and tell him everything, but rather the first thing is you have to get into the right mood, because just imagine you go there every day, you're just having so much fun in your palaces doing, and everyone's gonna, you have to sit down, so you have to think, oh no, I have to do this again. So the first thing is, O king, talking to Mars Prickett, jesters would entertain the Lord by displaying various comic moods. Expert entertainers would perform for him, and female dancers would dance energetically. Purport. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur points out that the word Natacharya refers, amongst other things, to expert magicians. All of these different entertainers, one after another, would perform for the Lord in the assembly of the great kings. Because we heard in the previous chapter how different times of the day are meant for different activities. They're just meant for different activities. So each set of different times of the day and each set of different activities requires a different mood to it. So this is the mood that's being set. The mentality has to be right before one can perform a particular activity or service properly. So these performers would dance and sing to the sound of madungas, veenas, murajas. You know what a muraja is? Have you ever heard of this? No, I also don't know. Flutes, everyone knows it. Flutes, cymbals, and conch shells. While professional poets, chroniclers, that means they tell the history, panegyrists is those who recite prayers and pray. And they would recite, what would they do? They would all recite the Lord's glories. And some brahmanas sitting in that assembly hall would fluently chant Vedic mantras, while others recounted stories of past kings and pious renown. So how the past kings acted, this is one of the elements of culture, that you'd hear about heroes, and that's why the Mahabharata is so full of, and the Ramayana is so full of heroic activities, not in the contemporary novels and stories. There's never a happy ending, good never triumphs over evil, and there are what's called anti-heroes. The main character is not much of a hero at all. So here, though, in the Vedic culture, one, by the process of hearing, One had one's mind focused on heroes who performed activities that one could emulate, one could follow, and be benefited by following. So especially the recounting the stories of the past kings who were pious, what were the qualities of kings that were pious?
Being charitable.
They're very charitable. So you hear about that, and yes, immediately. And they were
noble.
They were noble. What do you mean by noble?
Righteous.
What do you mean by righteous?
Fixed in religiosity and.
You know, their character was very high and pious. And they acted according to principles. So in the midst of all this, it was like a great festival in a sense, but it all was very purposeful. A messenger came because there was a problem. So once a certain person, Tatraika Purusho Rajan, one person, Agata Apurva Darshana, Apurva Darshana, no one had previously seen him before. Agato. He came, but no one had previously seen him before. Who was this messenger? What was the mission that had brought him to the royal assembly house of the Yadus? Vigyapito Bhagavate Patiharai Praveshitaha. So, when he arrived at the door, the doorkeepers announced him to the Lord, and then they brought him inside. So you really thought you were entering into something quite wonderful and seeing someone wonderful. Sa namaskritya Krishnaya. So he immediately, approaching the Lord, the Almighty Lord sitting on his throne, namaskritya, he bowed down Krishnaya to Lord Krishna, who is the Para Ishaya, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And with Krita Anjali, he did Anjali, he folded his hands very respectfully after bowing down, and Rajnam Avedayat, he submitted to Krishna the plight, dukkham, the suffering of Rajnam, of the kings who had been imprisoned, Jarasandha Narodajam. They were suffering so much because they had been imprisoned by Jarasandha. He brought the message of their plight to him, to Krishna. So he did this. That's why that's one of the things that the kings do, surrounded by their ministers. They deal with the problems of anyone. The door is open. And they deal with the problems of the citizens or anyone else who needs help. They were Kshatriyas, they were warriors, they had that nobility. Therefore, they heard about the pious activities of previous kings. There was one king, not even in Vedic times, but in the last, not 1,000 years, but before that, he used to have, maybe between 1,000 and 2,000 years ago, in India, there would be a golden chain that would stretch several hundred meters or something outside the king's chamber, the assembly hall. And then anyone who had a problem or who disagreed or a difficulty, who disagreed with someone, something that was going on, he would pull on the chain and get the idea was that he would get the king's attention and then he would be allowed to come in and voice his concern. So it was really not a dictatorship. So what were the nature of these kings that had been caught by Jarasandha? 20,000 kings had refused to submit absolutely to Jarasandha during his world conquest. They had been forcibly imprisoned by him in the fortress that was named Girivraj, but it wasn't Giriraj, and it wasn't Braj, but it was Girivraja. And he had a desire. He had caught these kings and he wanted to perform. There were 20,000 kings. They were obviously not all emperors, but they had their little kingdoms. He wanted to worship Mahabhairav, a very heavy form of Lord Shiva, by offering these kings in sacrifice to him. They were going to kill him. He was going to kill them all and offer them in sacrifice. He was so powerful that he could do this. So the kings, the messenger of the kings, brought the message of the kings now. So there's, okay, how many verses here? To 31. So they're going to speak from 25 to 31, seven verses. The king said, this was what he told him, O Krishna, 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 Prameyatman, O Krishna, O immeasurable soul, O destroyer of fear for those surrendered to you. Despite our separatist attitude, we have come to you for shelter out of fear of material existence. So here they're saying they are afraid, and then in the next three verses they describe their fear, and then in the final two verses they make their request. First verse, they explain that they're afraid of what? Material existence. Next three verses, what is their fear, and then what is their request? So three verses describing their fear. People in this world are always engaged in sinful activities and are thus bewildered about their real duty, which is to worship you according to your commandments. This activity would truly bring them good fortune. Let us offer obeisances unto the all-powerful Lord, who appears as time and suddenly cuts down one's stubborn hope for a long life in this world. So they're experiencing, this is what they're experiencing. Time in the form of Jarasandha has come, and they had their kingly plans, bewildered about their real duty. And what is their real duty? To worship you according to how you wish to be worshipped, according to your commands, according to the injunctions. And if they would do, instead of doing that, the king is saying, everyone has a self-created duty that they make believe is important. And if they would just follow what Krishna says, it would bring them true good fortune. And then they offer their obeisances to time, which cuts down all their plans for their imaginary, illusory good fortune, their stubborn hope for a long life in this world. Second verse. One verse says that they're afraid. Three verses say what their fear is. And then their request. So you are the predominating Lord of the universe, and you have descended into this world with your personal power to protect the saintly and to suppress the wicked. We cannot understand, O Lord, how anyone can transgress your law and still continue to enjoy the fruits of his work. So, they couldn't understand, Vishwanatha Kavati Thakur says, how is it possible that Jarasandha is going against what you want? We also think like this. How is it possible that this bad person is able to do this in the material world, and he seems to be so happy, and all the devotees struggle so much? So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says they could not understand how Jarasandha, who harassed the saintly devotees and who nourished the envious, what was an example of him nourishing the envious, Jarasandha? Who did he marry his daughters to? He did. I'll give you a hint. He was Krishna's, I'll give you a hint, he was Krishna's mother's brother's wife's father. That makes it obvious. Krishna's mother. In the Torah.
Devaki.
Brother. Who was Devaki's brother?
Kamsa.
Yes, Kamsa. Wife's father. In other words, Jarasandha's daughters were married to Kamsa. So that he was completely envious and evil, so he was. So therefore, after Krishna killed Kamsa, immediately Jarasandha attacked Mathura. How many times?
17.
Too many times. So how is it possible that we're suffering so much, and this Jarasandha, who is so evil and envious, he's enjoying? And the third verse describing their fear, O Lord, with this corpse-like body, which is always full of fear, we bear the burden of the relative happiness of a king, which is just like a dream. Thus, we have rejected the real happiness of the soul, which comes by rendering selfless service to you. Being so very wretched, we simply suffer in this life under the spell of your illusory energy. Telling what the problem is here. They sound like they want to make that their suffering, their distress, artha jigyasa artha ti, has inspired them to approach the lotus feet of the Lord and surrender. So there are some purports here, some comments. That verse, second verse of the three. How is it that wicked Kamsa is prospering and we're suffering so much? How could a person like Jarasandha go against your law and continue to enjoy the fruits of his work?
That's a very contemporary issue, isn't it? I mean, to say, you see that. All kinds of improper conduct is being recommended and taken up by the people of the world at large under the influence of power of certain, you know, powerful forces within society. And how come that goes on and God doesn't stop it?
That is the best.
Or a war, or, you know, I guess it's a bit. It looks a bit like he's not.
How come the bad guys win?
Yeah,
and they seem to prosper.
And we can say that, okay, that they all have to die, but the good guys die too, see?
And they sometimes die before the bad guys. So
where's
this,
God in it all?
Well, Sridhar Swami explains that the kings were bewildered by the sufferings that had come upon them.
Mm-hmm.
They stayed here that since the Lord had descended to this world to protect the pious and punish the wicked, how is it that Jarasandha, who brazenly transgressed the order of the Lord, continued to perform his wicked activities, whereas the kings, who were nice people, never did anything wrong, but maybe a little bit. they were put into a miserable condition.
They were killed as well.
Yeah, that's the miserable condition. They were imprisoned and ready to get the axe. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur similarly states that the kings could not understand how Jarasandha, who harassed the saintly devotees and nourished the envious, could continue to prosper where the kings were being tormented by the wicked Jarasandha. Similarly, Srila Prabhupada quotes the kings as follows in his Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. My dear Lord, you are the proprietor of all the worlds, and you have incarnated yourself along with your plenary expansion, Lord Balaram. It is said that your appearance in this incarnation is for the purpose of protecting the faithful and destroying the miscreants. Under the circumstances, how is it possible that miscreants like Jarasandha can put us into such deplorable conditions of life against your authority? Mm. Are you sanctioning this? No, it's against your desire, against your words, and yet they seem to be quite successful at it. Mm. We are puzzled at the situation, and we cannot understand how it is possible. So they don't become atheists. That's what the modern people, they become atheists when they think like this. But these kings were kings, and they were more pious. It may be that Jarasandha has been deputed to give us such trouble because of our past misdeeds. But we have heard from revealed scriptures that anyone who surrenders unto your lotus feet immediately becomes immune to the reactions of sinful life. We therefore wholeheartedly offer ourselves unto your shelter, and we hope that your lordship will now give us full protection. So this is Jana Sukritina Arjuna Arta Arta Tikigyasi Arta Arta Tikigyasi Gyani Cha Bharatar Sabha. That this is when a pious person is in distress, this is what he does. He takes shelter of the Lord, even for the removal of that distress. And then in the third verse there's a comment. So they have expressed their doubt, and now they're saying, we've been in so much illusion, we've been trying to get happiness on the physical level, and have neglected the happiness of the soul. And we have just suffered under your illusory energy. Now we know the real nature of the illusory energy that you cannot enjoy here. Purport. After expressing their doubts in the previous verse, the kings herein admit that actually they are suffering because of their own foolishness. Having given up the eternal happiness of the soul in exchange for the temporary conditional happiness of a so-called kingly position. Most people make a similar mistake, desiring wealth, power, prestige, aristocratic family, and so on, in exchange for their own soul. Yeah, they hook themselves into the grid of the material world and give up their solar energy. And they have to pay. They get the bill. That's what happens. When you're hooked up to the grid, you get your bill.
Karmic bill.
Huh?
Karmic bill.
You but you can do lots of things like that, you know. You can run all kinds of equipment. And
but you get the bill.
That's true, but in the meantime, you can just enjoy it.
And then you get the bill.
But, you know, that's after.
Then you get disconnected.
I'm bankrupt studying.
They're already bankrupt. Living off credit. And then the credit crunch comes. The kings, most people make a similar mistake. The kings admit that they have fallen under the spell of the Lord's illusory energy. What is the illusory energy telling them? What is it? Under the spell, enchanted.
You can enjoy. You will enjoy.
Yeah.
You're a king.
You're a king. You can enjoy. You have your little kingdom.
Single days.
There was that television program when we were growing up. It was called Queen for a Day. They get this poor lady housewife in
there. Lady for a Day, I think it was called.
No, oh, yeah. Queen for a Day. They didn't want to blaspheme Elizabeth the second, third, whatever.
And
they give her a new washing machine. They, you know, bring in her long-lost brother from that she hasn't seen. And then the next day, what happens?
Nothing.
Back into a mouse.
Your house worth the washing machine.
Kings admit they have fallen under the spell of the Lord's illusory energy and have mistaken the tremendous anxiety of political leadership for happiness. Such a struggle. The constant struggle and anxiety. Now, that was the problem, and now they are proposing their solution. Therefore, since your feet relieve the sorrow of those who surrender to them, please release us prisoners from the shackles of karma, manifest as the king of Magadha. Magadha means where? Where is Magadha?
Bihar, isn't it?
Bihar.
Yes.
Yes. There is an old Indian curse. May you be born in Bihar. But out of all the Biharis, the best is Ras Bihari. Ras Bihari. You have seen Ras Bihari? You have got Tanda. How did you get? Because the weather became cold. It's never like this in Bombay.
Under AC.
Huh?
Under AC.
Did you leave the AC on last night?
Oh. Everywhere.
So our karma has come in the form of the king of Magadha. And wielding alone the prowess of 10,000 maddened elephants, he has locked us up in his house just as a lion captures sheep. And there is no hope that we can escape by our own power. O wielder of the disc, your strength is unlimited, and Jarasandha only has the prowess of 10,000 maddened elephants, but your strength is unlimited. You are almighty. Thus, 17 times you crushed Jarasandha in battle, but then, absorbed in human affairs, you allowed him to defeat you once. Now, he is so filled with pride that he dares to torment us, your subjects. Oh, unconquerable one, please rectify the situation. So that's what the messenger walked into the assembly hall, saw the Lord, the Almighty Lord, sitting on his almighty throne. He folds it. Not an old man. Now here's the purport. The word Nri Loka Niritam indicates that the Lord was absorbed in playing within this world of human beings. Thus, while acting like a human king, he allowed Jarasandha to be victorious in a single battle after the Lord had crushed him 17 times. Crushed him and humiliated him. Let him go. Insignificant goal. The kings here imply that Jarasandha is especially harassing them because their souls surrendered to Lord Krishna. Therefore, they beg the Lord, O you who hold the chakra weapon high, please make the proper arrangement to free us. Srila Prabhupada expresses the king's feelings as follows. My dear Lord, you have already fought with Jarasandha 18 times consecutively, out of which you have defeated him 17 times by surpassing his extraordinary powerful position. But in your 18th fight, you exhibited human behavior. And thus it appeared that you were defeated. What did Krishna do?
Ran short.
He ran short. He ran from the battle.
Is that what then by exhibiting human behavior? They don't sort of know anything has happened after that.
They don't know. It doesn't appear that they know.
Just know that it appears as if he ran away.
Yes. And unfortunately, that's what it appears.
Mm.
And why did he, what did he do? What did he do? Who knows what he did? This was in the...
Trying to chase him?
Answered the plea of his future wife.
Yes, this, I think the 51st.
Jarasandha chased him, right?
Jarasandha chased him, and this was after the killing of Muchukunda, not the, the killing of Kaliyavana by Muchukunda. He went back to the battlefield and walked out, and Jarasandha chased him, and
there were two persons attacking.
At the same time, Kaliyavana and his army, who was this,
yeah.
I think the grandson of Gauga Rishi, and at the same time Jarasandha attacked. So it was a huge thing.
Yes. So he wanted to protect,
So what did he do?
He transferred all the citizens to Dwarka.
He ran and Kaliyavana followed him.
Oh no, but that was after this, after that. What did he do?
Did he go back to the battlefield and
yes, and then then he came out and
his father and both ran away.
What did they do?
They got in the chariots and went, and
they
and
did not.
Jarasandha followed them, and they ran up to a mountain.
They went into a mountain. They climbed up this huge mountain.
They set fire.
It was huge, and they went to the top. And they couldn't find them. Jarasandha and the men couldn't find them, so they set fire to the mountain, and Krishna and Balaram
jumped off.
The 86 miles down to the ground. Now that was a tall mountain.
Yeah.
Again, so?
We don't have such mountains.
Huh?
We don't have such
mountains.
86
miles.
No.
But even if, like, if you think even though there's such a tall mountain, but oftentimes there are roads that go around mountains, you know. There's ways that you can also get to the top of the mountain that takes a lot of miles. And if it's not, at least you rode mountains like that.
You're not going to be able to get out so easily. It was 86 miles high.
Was it 86 miles above the sea level?
You're saying what I was saying. Connecting the material with crystal.
And that was. I think they know which mountain it was. So in any case, I can't comment much on this. But they said. So that's what happened, and then Krishna. Then he began dealing with Rukmini. So no one can equal or surpass you. The appearance of defeat by Jarasandha in the 18th engagement is nothing but an exhibition of human behavior. Unfortunately, foolish Jarasandha could not understand your tricks, and he has since then become puffed up over his material power and prestige. Specifically, he has arrested us and imprisoned us, knowing fully that as your devotees, we are subordinate to your sovereignty. So they're saying, please take care of us. The messenger continued, this is the message of the kings imprisoned by Jarasandha, who all hanker for your audience, having surrendered to your feet. Please bestow good fortune on these poor souls. And just as soon, the very moment that the messenger of the kings had finished delivering the message, the Surishi, the Devarishi, Narada Muni himself, Narada Rishi, appeared. He had just come, and he had come back. He suddenly appeared. bearing a mass of golden matted locks on his head, the supremely frozen sage entered like the brilliant sun. Lord Krishna is the worshipable master of even planetary rulers like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. Yet as soon as he saw that Narada Muni had arrived, he joyfully stood up along with his ministers and secretaries to receive the great sage and offer him respectful obeisances by bowing his head. Why had Narada Muni come? This we shall find out.
He went away and came back again?
Huh? Oh, he appeared, yeah. Because he went to travel, but we shall find out. He wants Krishna, sees it as opportune. So we shall hear, but you shall not hear. You will be away in Kiwi land. Any questions or comments? Yes.
It seems like the kings couldn't accept that Krishna sanctioned for their suffering in such atrocities.
They couldn't accept.
Yeah, they couldn't accept that. You know,
they wanted release.
Yeah. So they were expressing that was against Krishna's will. You know, so
because they were acting, because Dharasandha was acting, he was specifically inimical to Krishna. Doing things that were against Krishna's desire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was inimical to Krishna, and how was he able to do this? Because it appears that they were devotees.
But Krishna sanctioned it.
Huh?
Krishna did sanction it, yeah. For this to happen. I mean, nothing. It said even a blade of grass is moved.
But they wanted it. They had their plan. They thought that Krishna should come and rescue them. And they weren't submissive to this, even if it was Krishna's plan. Because sometimes, as it turns out here, this was only part of Krishna's plan, that he imprisoned, that they become imprisoned by Dharasandha. The other part was they would call him. The kings would call Krishna, he would come and rescue them, kill Dharasandha.
Sometimes it takes a kind of a certain type of a catastrophe to draw one's attention to a situation that needs to be recognized. So they were part of the catastrophe.
Because Krishna was waiting for his opportunity to kill Dharasandha at the right time. But you're bringing up that sometimes when something happens, we're expected, okay, this must be Krishna's arrangement, and just accept it.
Is it always?
And then other times we complain to Krishna, come and save us, like the kings did. So how do you know when to say, oh, okay, Krishna, it must be your mercy, and how do you know when to call out to Krishna for help? That's, in one sense, that's what you're asking. So, there's the common sense element. First of all, if we're engaged in Krishna's service, and we know what's going to please Krishna, so if something happens counterproductive to Krishna's service, one doesn't just sit back and say, it must be Krishna's mercy, because it's not Krishna's mercy, it's against his desire. So one goes to Krishna for help and at the same time acts practically. So they didn't just pray to Krishna for help, they sent a messenger to go into, who entered the court of the Sudama Assembly House. So they acted practically too. And they're doing that. And then we try our best to act practically, taking shelter of Krishna, and then if it appears that all is lost anyway, then we, there must be some arrangement. Of Krishna, there must be some mercy of Krishna hidden in this, like Maharaj Prickett. He just accepted, didn't he? He could have changed everything from the curse that was going to cause his death. But he didn't, he just accepted. That's how Krishna inspired him. But Krishna had a plan and he worked his plan through that meaning of that unfortunate event, he worked his plan. So the Bhagavatam could be spoken. And then also another example is with Chitraketu, when he was cursed by poverty, by Parvati. Okay, I'm doing better. He was cursed by Parvati, and he said, anyway, I didn't do anything wrong, but I accepted. He could have counter-cursed her, maybe extracted himself, but he just accepted it. It's Krishna's arrangement.
Can you extract yourself by a counter-curse?
Huh?
How do you extract yourself
by curse? May the curse go back upon you and shatter your head. Something. Or retaliated. So how do you know which to do when? So when you don't know what to do, you use your common sense and act practically. And accept that whatever Krishna, the outcome that Krishna desires is going to happen.
Sometimes when we act practically, we can get caught up in the illusion that it's by our doing that, you know, we got out of the situation.
Is that true?
I mean, that has happened to me.
But we can get caught up in the illusion. But is it true that it is by our doing?
No, but it appears like it at the time when you're doing it.
That's because it's an illusion, as you said.
Yes.
That's what he said.
I mean, how do you get a balance? I mean,
it's not a balance, it's how do you get out of illusion. We should know that we're completely dependent on Krishna. We have no power other than the power that Krishna gives us. It's called humility. So the material world will gradually break our pride, thinking that we can do something on our own. Because that's what happened to the kings, basically. They were going on their way, you know, thinking they were kings, using their powers, and then Krishna came to them in the form of Jarasandha to show them that they were to bring to their attention their dependence on Krishna. So it's not only when they needed the help of Krishna when being imprisoned by Jarasandha that they were actually dependent on Krishna. If Krishna withdrew their power and energy at any time, they would have nothing. That everyone could accept, right? You get some horrible disease or some little fall, everything can be taken away. You could be riding a horse or a car and you could finish like that. One lose all ability to move one's body.
Do we have to always...
So is that illusion or is that reality that we're dependent on Krishna's disposition?
That's a reality.
It appears to be, doesn't it? But in illusion, we forget that. So what were you asking?
Do we always have to act practically when we're in a state of despair? I mean, can't prayer just do? Calling out to Krishna? I mean, do we have to, like, you know, each chanting his holy names or, you know, engaging in some kind of service or...
I saw you. What do you mean by acting practically?
Practically. I mean, you said that, you know, we should, you know, pray to Krishna, you know, when we're in a state of despair and act practically. Call out to Krishna and act practically.
Yeah.
But does it always have to be...
Would be acting practically. Means you try your best to extract yourself in the situation. That's the general way we act.
Mm.
That was the example we saw with Prabhupada. Like in Juhu, when there was such a struggle for the land, he prayed to Krishna, but he fought like anything.
Mm.
And that was what part of the message of the Bhagavad Gita.
Mm.
Even though Nimittakaran Bhava Savya Sachin Arjuna was going to be the Nimittakaran, the instrumental cause, but Krishna wanted him to fight.
Strange, but sometimes it's a little difficult because we ourselves are not so pure, so when you're just thinking about acting practically, I'm not quite sure if it's just your fault, your false ego.
Well, it is. But yet we know what reality is. And if the earlier we recognize it, obviously even more fortunate we are. So we might not, we won't be able to do it perfectly, because we tend to act impulsively, you know. And we tend to think, I got myself out of it. But it's illusion.
But sometimes just by prayer, you get the inspiration to act practically. You know, I mean, sometimes you may not know what to do, but, you know, just by prayer itself, just calling out to Krishna, then you're inspired to surrender to someone, you know.
Out of the practical action?
That's not what I was... it ended in that anyway. In other words, sometimes you know what Krishna wants you to do to get out of the circumstance. Sometimes you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't know and then you call out to Krishna and then you do know. Sometimes you do know immediately. Sometimes you call out to Krishna and you still don't know. Now, there's various options and alternatives of the way the thing can break for us or not break for us.
Mm.
So, if we know what to do, if Krishna gives us inspiration of what to do, we do it immediately. If Krishna doesn't, we call out to him. And then if he gives us an inspiration, we act on it. If he doesn't, we use our intelligence as best we can. This is the best you've given me right now, Lord Krishna, but then you're depending on him and the use of this. You might not have enough time. The train is rushing down the track and your car stalls on the track and you're right in the way. You gotta get out of the car. Fast. And Krishna gives inspiration.
I guess ultimately, if you're saved or not, one can do it as Krishna's mercy either way.
Well, you do your part and just... It's not a matter of what we view it.
Mm.
It's a matter of we do... What Krishna's part in the operation is and what our part is. So we do our part and let Krishna do his part. Because then if you take it like that whatever happens we will say it's Krishna's mercy, it's true. You get a difference. If you're a devotee, you have one vision, and a materialist will have another vision. The materialist will say, well, if the train wrecks your car and kills you and you or your family members and you say it's Krishna's mercy, what's the difference between Krishna's mercy and a disaster? But the devotee, if he's deep enough, he can actually see Krishna's mercy in everything. He gets light in the darkness. He gets vision. therefore he can, a devotee can live in this world happily, regardless of the externals. And that's what Lord Shiva pointed out to Parvati when Chitraketu accepted the curse. But to see the devotees, to see the amazing consciousness they have, they see Krishna's mercy in a disaster. She cursed him to become a demon. And actually, there was Krishna's mercy in that, because as Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains, he was missing Chitraketu, so he was calling him back to him quickly. There was Krishna's desire, part of his plan. But we don't know until the end, until it's over, what the plan was. If one has faith, then one can live happily in the world, sheltered by the knowledge that I'm under Krishna's protection. If one doesn't have faith, one will always be saying, is this really Krishna's protection, or is this just my imagination, and am I imagining the whole thing? Is Krishna's hand in this? What do I do? So it depends on the quality of one's faith. And then the question, well, which really is it then? If it just depends on your faith, does it depend on your mind, or is it really Krishna? Then, of course, the devotees accept that it's actually Krishna. Because once one surrenders to Krishna, he's no longer direct under his faith in him. This is what the kings were saying. Directly under Krishna. Is that true, or is it just some story? I have to decide.
Does that mean the Chitraketus were just vanished and a demon occurred?
And what?
And a demon occurred? Because remember, he came out of the fire, right? He just came out of the fire. He didn't get born and grow up in the family.
He grew up in the father was a fire. Fired up.
So Chitraketu just went, foot, and then whoosh.
With the sound effects. I'm sure. Bhagavatam doesn't mention
it. He's like, too bad.
He became an ember and then reignited himself.
Probably would have very hard time believing it if they did mention it. You know, talking about all the souls falling down in the rain, you know. It's like, you
really
have a lot of faith.
What about poor Pratik? He's got a cold.
He's got a lot of ginger.
Put some heat in the body and rest tomorrow. Who's cooking tomorrow? If we sit like that, I'm not sure.
Should be alright.
He'll probably wear a handkerchief because he smells like a bandit.
Like a Zen.
Give some peace.
One thing is, you have to wash all the paraphernalia and stuff. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.